The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Greetings, listeners. This is Wendy Byrne bringing you the Corvallis Civics Cafe, covering the second full week of March. While the month started off with a teaser of sunshine and flowers and more light in the later part of the day, winter came back to remind us that the spring equinox is a little ways off, so come inside the cafe and warm up while you have a listen to what I've prepared. As last week was the second week of the month, and the city council meetings occur on the first and third weeks of each month, it was a quiet week for the council, but things were still simmering on the stove for us here at the cafe. On Monday, March 10th, there was a meeting of the Safe Streets and Roads for All Task Force. If you are interested in transportation safety, including improvements for all modes of transportation, you might know that in 2024, the city won a large grant from the Federal Highway Administration to help fund the development of a Transportation Safety Action Plan, and that work is being guided by this task force. Sound interesting? There is going to be an open house on this subject on April 3rd from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library on Northwest Monroe Avenue. Mark your calendars and come to the open house. Your input can help guide the development of the safety plan. At the end of last week's Civics Cafe, I mentioned that budget season is coming, and in fact, things got cooking on Tuesday, March 11th, with the City Budget Commission's orientation meeting. Here are some facts about the Budget Commission. The Budget Commission is a local government's fiscal planning advisory body. Oregon budget law requires local governments to have a budget commission as part of the budget approval process. For Corvallis, the commission is established through the Corvallis Municipal Code. Our budget commission consists of all 9 members of the city council and 9 members of electors appointed by the governing body. The annual budget is the city's financial plan containing estimates of revenues and expenditures. In addition to allocating resources among departments and community programs, the budget also governs the city's spending authority and encourages community feedback and participation. Oregon's local budget law is defined by Oregon revised statutes that require local governments to prepare and adopt annual or biennial budgets following a very specific process. If you go to the city website, corvallisoregon.gov, and navigate your way to the page about the Budget Commission, you will see that for 2025, the Budget Commission is scheduled to meet to review the fiscal year 2025 to 2027 proposed budget starting in May. The dates listed are May 8th, May 12th, May 13th, 14th, and 15th. The goal is for the city budget to be reviewed by the Budget Commission in May, then sent to the City Council for approval in June, and in place by July 1st because the fiscal year runs from July 1st to June 30th. However, there are 2 additional meeting dates that are not listed on that page. One was last week, the orientation meeting on the 11th, and the other is the City Council and Budget Commission joint work session next week on March 20th. Wait a minute here, you might say. What is going on with Budget Commission meetings in March? The calendar says meetings start in May. The orientation meeting is useful because it gives the staff of the Finance Department a chance to touch base with the members of the Budget Commission. It also gives the members of the Budget Commission a chance to ask questions and familiarize themselves with each other and with staff. The March work session is interesting because the entire 2 hours of its agenda are devoted to the review of something that is directly tied to the city budget, the city's Capital Improvement Program. The Capital Improvement Program, also known as the CIP, is a 5-year planning document produced by our Department of Public Works, which lists projects that are necessary to keep the city functioning and the anticipated costs of those projects. The project categories are, in alphabetical order, the airport, buildings, parks and recreation, stormwater, transportation, wastewater, and water. In the past, the expenses of the first year of the Capital Improvement Program are incorporated into the city budget. As Corvallis is moving from yearly budgeting to every 2-year budget, also known as biennial budgeting, this year the first 2 years of the Capital Improvement Program will be incorporated into the budget. And here is the special sauce. If you or I have any input to offer on these projects, and thus their costs, the time to speak to it is next week, on or before the meeting on March 20th, not in May. Officially, the Capital Improvement Program might not be a budget document, but it does impact the budget, and the budget can impact it. If you are interested in following the money, your attention to this process is relevant. You can find more information about the Capital Improvement Program on the city website. Go to CorvallisOregon.gov and in the search field type in Capital Improvement Program. And if you have comments to make, send them in before March 20th or attend the meeting in person on Thursday. This joint work session of the Corvallis City Council and Budget Commission will take place at 4 p.m. in City Council chambers on the second floor of the downtown fire station. According to the Director of Finance, James Inglis, the idea is that if there are changes that need to be made to the Capital Improvement Program based on public input, it is best to identify these changes before May so that they can be accounted for when staff brings the proposed budget to the Budget Commission during its May meetings and to avoid last-minute changes to the city budget. There was also a rather rare occurrence last week. No, not the lunar eclipse. I'm referring to the joint meeting of the Corvallis City Council and the Benton County Board of Commissioners. On Wednesday, March 12th, they met to hold a public hearing. At the hearing, they considered testimony and reviewed and unanimously approved a comprehensive plan map amendment request. The property in question lies outside of the official city limits but within the urban growth boundary, just north of the intersection of Highway 99 and Lewisburg Road. This property has been zoned residential, but always functioned as a commercial property. Years ago, it was, essentially, a junkyard. Then it was purchased by the owners of Buena Vista Arbor Care and is currently in use as the commercial location for Bartlett Tree Experts. By recommendations from both the Corvallis Planning Commission and the Benton County Planning Commission, and then by unanimous decisions of both the City Council and the Benton County Board of Commissioners, the zoning and comprehensive plans for the property now fit the long-term use of the property. Since we have touched on items related to Benton County, that brings up, how do you pay attention to the Benton County government happenings? Did you know that there is a new Board of Commissioners meeting portal on their website? The website for Benton County government can be found at boc.bentoncountyor.gov. Let me read to you from the March 10th newsletter that I received via email last week. I quote, "Last week, Benton County rolled out a new Board of Commissioners meeting portal. With it, you can view board meeting information, see meeting agendas, materials, and minutes, attend meetings virtually, join meetings through Zoom. Special note, meetings will no longer be available as a YouTube live stream. Find information fast. Use bookmarks to easily navigate large meeting packets and on-demand videos. Stay connected. Subscribe to get alerts when new meeting materials are published. Use accessibility features. Access videos with closed captions and download meeting transcripts. Explore past meeting records. Search past meeting agendas and minutes dating back 10 years for information about topics that matter to you. More historical meeting records will be added in the coming months." End quote. I've looked at the website and agree it is much easier than the previous iteration. While Corvallis Civics Cafe will continue to focus on city-related information, I'd be remiss if I had not mentioned this information about Benton County to you. If you are interested in the civics of Benton County, it just got a lot easier to find stuff, and my opinion is that they can use our attention. For city meetings this coming week, on Monday, March the 17th, the City Council has an executive session starting at 4:30 p.m., followed by their business meeting starting at 6 p.m. in Council Chambers on the second floor of the downtown fire station. While the public cannot attend executive sessions, business meetings are open to the public for in-person and online attendance. On Thursday, March 20th, starting at 4 p.m., and also taking place in Council Chambers at the downtown fire station, the City Council will have the work session I detailed earlier in the show today. This meeting is open to the public, both in person and online. Don't have time to attend? I'll do my best to bring you details about these meetings on Corvallis Civics Cafe next week. If you have any comments or questions about the material I've shared, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's news, music, and civics, email us at news@korcfm.com. Thanks for tuning in to the show. The show airs on Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m. and repeats on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. And Civics Cafe can also be heard on Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. following The Many Moods of Ben Vaughn.
Here are some local happenings that you might want to know about. On March 21st at 5:30 p.m., you can join the Spring Equinox Bike Party. The meetup will start at the Spicy Petals Bike Shop and will be a mostly flat 7-mile ride. From March 4th to April 5th, the Corvallis Arts Center is hosting a month-long exposition of locally produced zines. On Saturday, March 22nd at Bombs Away Cafe, we have Strange Rotation playing some new jazz fusion, along with Folktronica act Figgy and sultry R&B Elena Michelle. And the same night, we have a free all-ages show over at Old World Deli featuring the Idle Hands Quartet. Looking ahead, on March 25th at 7 p.m. at Interzone, we have a group from Milwaukee described as indie power pop. The band's called Holy Pinto, and they'll have some local support to be determined. On April 3rd at the Corvallis Museum, Corvallis Experiments in Noise is hosting Tuvan Shaman Chinggis Khan for some Tuvan shamanism and throat singing, a shamanistic spirit song and healing ritual. Suggested donation of $10 to $20. Finally, looking way out to May, we'll remind you about this again. The Heart of the Valley Anti-Capitalist Book Fair will occur at locations around Corvallis to be determined. It'll be a veritable festival of radical offerings to sample, including book talks, anarcho-hootenannies, a tabling fair with organizations from the region, state, and beyond, leftist sports, workshops, and more. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics on 105.9 FM. We're also streaming 24/7 worldwide at korcfm.com.
This is Wendy Byrne bringing you a list of city meetings starting Monday, March 17th. The Housing Operational Committee will meet virtually at 12 p.m. on Monday, March 17th. The committee meets as needed to assist staff with preparing draft documents for policy change that will eventually be presented to the council for review. The agenda and packet for the meeting can be found on the city website at corvallisoregon.gov. On Monday, March 17th, at 4:30 p.m., the City Council will meet in executive session to conduct deliberations with persons designated by the governing body to carry on labor negotiations and to conduct deliberations with persons designated by the governing body to negotiate real property transactions. Executive session meetings are not open to the public. The meeting will take place at the downtown fire station at 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard in City Council chambers on the second floor. Also on Monday, March 17th, starting at 6 p.m., there will be a business meeting for the Corvallis City Council. Everyone is welcome and encouraged to attend City Council meetings. This meeting will be held in person and virtually. See the published agenda for more meeting details and participation instructions at corvallisoregon.gov. The meeting will take place at the downtown fire station, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard, on the second floor in Council Chambers. On Wednesday, March 19th, at 5 p.m., the Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Board will be meeting virtually. Information about the meeting is available on the city website at corvallisoregon.gov. Also on Wednesday, March 19th, at 6:30 p.m., there will be a meeting of the Planning Commission. Planning Commission meetings are conducted online only. The agenda and packet of information for the meeting can be found at the city webpage at corvallisoregon.gov. On Thursday, March 20th, at 4 p.m., the City Council and Budget Commission will hold a joint work session. Everyone is welcome and encouraged to attend City Council work sessions. This joint work session will be held in person and virtually. The published agenda of work session details is available on the city website at corvallisoregon.gov. This work session will take place at the downtown fire station, which is at 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. The council chambers are located on the second floor.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall. And next we're going to hear audio from a public meeting outside of the Corvallis Civics Zone. in Shasta County, California. The sentiment and tone is why I am sharing this with you today. For a little context, the voice we'll hear is that of Nathaniel Pinckney, a resident of Redding, California, who speaks out regularly against local toxic politicians or other elected officials in his area. This particular audio we're going to hear just happened to go viral, probably because of it being kind of funny. In this case, he showed up to a meeting that took place after a 28-year sheriff who sued the county was on his way out, and that is his main target in the following speech. According to Action News Now, Sergeant Kropholler's lawsuit against Shasta County alleges that former Sheriff Eric Magrini asked him to use the California law enforcement telecommunications system to perform an illegal background check on someone who was a CEO applicant. Kropholler claims that when he refused to comply with the request, he was mistreated by his superiors. I spoke with Nathaniel Pinckney on the phone last week after obtaining this audio of his comments at the public meeting that went viral. He told me this particular sheriff, who aligns himself with the politics of Donald Trump and MAGA, has a long history of conduct unbecoming of a public official. While this recording is from outside of our area and references political drama that is local to Redding, California and Shasta County, I want you to notice Nathaniel's boldness and courage. We live in an age where many of us have been beaten into submission. Fear of losing our job or social standing has moved many of us to the back of the room in silence or out the door altogether with apathy instead of showing up and holding bad politicians accountable. We also live in times where many of us have the economic strain and reality of late-stage capitalism, where average people can't afford capitalism anymore, and that keeps us bound in fear and well-behaved and working away our lives in a job or career, not showing up to agitate or create accountability, much less run for office, and create positive change ourselves. Meanwhile, corrupt and bad politicians thrive on this. Without local engagement and accountability, they do whatever they want and often give confusing or legalese-filled answers to a confused, increasingly overwhelmed, and disinterested public. Here in Corvallis, for instance, our city has incurred legal expenses near $500,000 because of what was an attempt to infringe on the First Amendment rights of a city councilor, Charlene Ellis, who was asking for a position on the Climate Advisory Board to be filled. The whole story is confusing and ridiculous, and at the end of the day, not a single explanation I've heard justifies this kind of expense to our city. From all the time I have spent trying to wrap my head around this story, the lawsuit, the situation, the resounding response from those who are in the know all agree it is petty and wasteful of not just the city's money, but time. Why can't we be focused on, say, things that will improve our city and quality of life when we're talking about these kinds of lawsuits? Now, sure, there are many people speaking up online, using multiple paragraphs on the local Reddit, on Nextdoor, or Facebook, and a few citizens show up in person to voice their discontent, but the process remains rather tedious and, in general, off-putting to the general public, which is part of why civic involvement seems like a waste of time to many locals. Our city council has also held hearings and meetings about upcoming projects and expenses, often without adequate time for the public to really weigh in and understand these expenses in a meaningful way. Like anywhere, if the public doesn't feel truly represented or like their voices are heard, we have become conditioned to just drop out of the process. Nathaniel Pinckney, whose voice is in the following clip of audio, is a voice of a young, engaged, perhaps rough around the edges, citizen of where he lives. He speaks up at local meetings on a regular basis and has made a name for himself in his community. He is planning to run for local office in Shasta County, California, and his words remind me that more of us need to show up and show a little courage. More of us need to speak up and rock the boat when it is needed. In the case of Nathaniel Pinckney, as you will hear, he was responding to an outgoing sheriff known for corruption, MAGA politics, and Nazi affiliation. Which, speaking of, Nazi sentiment is growing before our very eyes. It can't be denied. It is up to all of us to extinguish those flames wherever we see them, even if it's just by speaking out. And in the case of this upcoming speech, in a way that garners real attention. You will notice that polite responses, using inside voices, and only polite and professional words, just writing an email, complaining on Nextdoor, it doesn't save the day. It's kind of the equivalent of congressional Democrats holding up tiny black signs during the recent State of the Union address. Texas Democrat Al Green was a lone dissenting voice of volume in that room. Eventually, he was escorted out. And then some of his fellow Democrats voted to censure him because he spoke too loudly and behaved outside the norm. This toxic politeness and constantly extinguishing the flames of our outspoken neighbors enables bad politicians to thrive, and it's part of why we're in the bad situation we're in. Citizens, be more bold. Show up. Let your voice be heard. Even if your style is a little different than this guy, Nathaniel Pinckney of Shasta County, California, collect your thoughts, take a deep breath, and show up. Local, state, and federal politicians need to know the people are watching and not just going to sit by politely.
I want to start off talking about that situation with Sergeant Krophaller earlier. I'm not restricted to say anything or can't say anything. I actually know some details on that. The allegation is that Sheriff McGreeny, Eric McGreeny, drew a Nazi mustache on Krophaller's official photo. That's the allegation. Basically called him a Nazi. But here's the thing. Sergeant Krophaller has a room in his house full of Nazi memorabilia. That's an actual fact. That's true. So our Board of Supervisors of Shasta County is about to award $2 million to a fucking Nazi. Yeah, that's what's about to happen. That's the truth. That's the actual truth. The same board that said the guy that said the N-word was exercising his freedom of speech. Yeah, anyways, on behalf of Shasta County, good goddamn riddance, Patrick Jones. You are the absolute worst thing that has ever happened to Shasta County. You are a liar, a manipulator, a misogynist, every kind of bigot, and just at your core, a horrible human being. I've heard that even your bones hate you, and they're crumpling up like so many tin cans under your skin. Guess what? You deserve that. Your entire goal for this, your baby, your pet project since you were a city councilman, was your gun range. It's all you've ever truly cared about, your gun range and promoting your gun shop. Let me ask you, do you feel like you're ever going to get to actually build that gun range? Because I don't. I think the people of Millville will fight you on it tooth and nail until your bones are too crumpled to even do it. I believe that you failed. You know why you failed? Because everything you did in office, every major decision was promote and benefit your own interests, from business to socio-political ideologies. Your race wasn't stolen from you like you so desperately claim. You are why you lost. You neglected your constituents even when they told you that your gun range could end up getting people killed, and you said, I don't care about that, and went ahead anyways. Your greed is what lost you this election. You have spent the last year retaliating against anyone employed by the county or even county adjacent. You have directly interfered in our elections while simultaneously screeching election interference. You've used threatening language against the public on multiple occasions, and you've got Dave Rickert so scared to do his job that nobody is even investigating the hostile work environment that you and your two goons have created for Tim and Mary during closed session. You are a menace, and I hope you live the life that you deserve. Tim and Mary, you two are amazing. Mary, you obviously should have won, but the lies of those three in the middle and their angry little sheep behind me were just too strong for the right thing to happen this time. I do, however, believe in karma, and I know that you will continue to serve this county in other ways. Tim, I can't wait for you to come back and take that ogre's lunch money next election. And guess what, Patrick? I brought you a present, actually, real quick, a little going-away present. Let me just find it here real quick. There it is. F*** you.
And with that, Nathaniel Pinckney of Shasta County, California, pulled his hand out of his pocket, a middle finger extended to the outgoing sheriff. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. The following story was published in the Corvallis Gazette Times on March 13, 2025, and was authored by Ella Hutcherson. Headline reads, Corvallis Businesses Fear Displacement After Homeless Services Group Buys Building. On January 14th, Renee Camacho and Halen Ortiz, cousins and co-owners of vintage and designer retailer End Zone Studios in downtown Corvallis, received a letter from property owner Charlie Ringo. In it, Ringo informed the young entrepreneurs that he is in negotiations to sell the entire building known as 4th Street Professional Center, home of End Zone and several other businesses, to the Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center, a support service for homeless individuals. The sale would allow the Drop-In Center to expand its offerings for impoverished community members in Corvallis, with a move that's just across from its current location. The building sale is far from certain, the letter read, but it is possible that you may be required to depart the premises by the middle of April. That timeline has since been murky, with Ringo telling Mid Valley Media that finances continue to be a hurdle for the Drop-In Center. But according to its executive director, Allison Hobgood, who has described Ringo as an ally to the CDDC's current efforts, the deal is still on track. As far as I'm concerned, we're moving towards closing any second, she said. The building is selling for $1.81 million, and the Drop-In Center has been running a capital campaign to support the purchase. The potential sale has thrown business owners like Camacho and Ortiz, who haven't yet worked in the building for a year, into a tailspin as they struggle to clarify the status of their livelihoods. Some businesses have already left the building preemptively. 10 months in, we have so much more to do, Camacho said about the End Zone. If this happens, it's almost like they're shutting the door on us. According to Allison Hobgood, the CDDC's current landlord sent its own lease termination letter last year, setting the must-leave date for March 31st of this year. That date has since been extended to accommodate the nonprofit's anticipated move. The building, also located on 4th Street, has been bought by former three-time All-American Oregon State University wrestler Les Gutches. Hobgood said that the Drop-In Center has been looking for an expanded space even before it became an absolute necessity. We are just in a tiny shoebox, she said. It's not doable for what we're trying to support people with. The CDDC, according to its website, currently provides information, referrals, and direct services to homeless and impoverished individuals in Benton County and beyond. The center provides opportunities to build community and social networks and supports the welfare and rehabilitation of individuals across, quote, emergency, transitional, and ongoing life circumstances, unquote. This support includes replacing documents, finding affordable housing, assisting with paying for prescriptions and emergency transportation, and receiving mail. The center also provides clothes, hygiene supplies, and a place to charge phones. The 4th Street Professional Center, thanks to its setup, has great potential for low-barrier nonprofit collaboration, Hobgood said. Other service-providing agencies, such as Corvallis Housing First, will be joining the endeavor, which will serve as a kind of quote-unquote resiliency hub. She's optimistic about the change, she said, and CDDC guests are stoked. The Drop-In Center already rents two offices in the 4th Street Professional Center that are part of its Healing Arts Collective, which is an art gallery. That's how they found out Ringo intended to sell the building, and he proposed a deal to the CDDC, according to Hobgood. My goal is to never have anybody lose the space that is home to them. That's the fundamental problem we're dealing with every day at the Drop-In Center, she said. A confluence of circumstances allowed her nonprofit to purchase from an owner looking to sell his building. It wasn't some quote-unquote evil plan, she said. In fact, the CDDC loves its neighbors. A lot of businesses in the complex, Ringo said, were on month-to-month leases, and in those cases knew that there was no commitment for the long term. On Wednesday, March 11th, Benton County approved a letter of support for the drop-in center's efforts to expand on a new, larger property, commending Oregon's U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley's office for earmarking $2 million to go toward the effort. The new location will foster greater community safety for all people and will allow for more wraparound care for those who need it most, the letter reads. Intercommunity Health Network, CCO, which supports Oregon's Medicaid program in Benton County, also donated $400,000, according to Hobgood, and has been the CDDC's largest community donor related to expanded drop-in center. During the 2024 point-in-time count, a one-day tally that can determine how many federal dollars come to an area, 416 homeless people were identified living in Corvallis. Camacho and Ortiz, along with other business owners on the lot, plan to come before Corvallis City Council this month to advocate for themselves and share concerns about the drop-in center's plan. Gabriel Fitzpatrick, owner of the used car dealer Rave Auto Sales, which is also in the 4th Street Professional Center, said his experience with the nearby Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center has been, quote, incredibly negative, unquote. In the last year, he said, he's called the police to his business at least 10 times due to the activity of homeless community members who frequent the center, activity he calls belligerent and rambunctious. Even if the businesses in the 4th Street Professional Center are displaced, Fitzpatrick said, other businesses in the surrounding area experience the same problems. Fitzpatrick started his business about 8 years ago while he was still in college. He's been a part of the 4th Street Professional Center for about 6 years, where he employs around 15 people. He found a location in the Toyota budget lot where Rave Auto Sales can move, quote, if worst comes to worst, unquote. Even if the complex doesn't sell, though, he said the Toyota lot will serve as his business's second location. Endzone Studios sells vintage streetwear and designer sneakers. It's cultivated a safe space for local youth, its owners say, with kids being able to quote-unquote kick it in the store rather than getting into trouble. Following the January letter, Camacho and Ortiz have been looking at other spots for the business, but everything is expensive, they said. They've even expanded their search up into Portland. Like Fitzpatrick, Camacho is concerned about the impacts of the drop-in center taking over the building, worrying that nonprofit is enabling Corvallis' homeless population. For his part, Ringo told Mid Valley Media that facilities like CDDC can be controversial. They provide good services, but there are some negative impacts, he said. People have to weigh those out. Ringo is no stranger to controversy himself. A former state senator, he was linked with the Ben Bulletin to black market marijuana activities in 2018. In 2016, Ringo sued Corvallis Housing First, which at the time was running the CDDC, to stop a proposed expansion. Ringo's 2016 complaint sought an injunction against the organization and $500,000 in damages. He told the Corvallis Gazette Times at the time that he wanted the nonprofit to, quote, permanently shut down the operation, unquote, on 4th Street. In the present day, Ringo says there's still a lot of uncertainty surrounding the sale of his building to the drop-in center. I predict it's going to fall through, he said, citing funding issues. If it doesn't, then it doesn't. He declined to specify further. That was a story from the Corvallis Gazette Times, dated March 13, 2025, and authored by Ella Hutcherson. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
The following are headlines from Democracy Now! From their Friday, March 14th show.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two federal judges, one in California, one in Maryland, on Thursday ordered 19 federal agencies to rehire some 20,000 probationary workers who'd recently been fired as part of President Trump and Elon Musk's massive government layoffs. The pair have also been blocked from further axing those agencies, including the Education Department, which announced this week it was reducing its workforce by roughly one half. The measures provide some temporary relief as labor groups, Democratic attorneys general, and others challenge the White House's attempt to dismantle the federal government. Separately, on Thursday, another federal judge ordered Elon Musk and a so-called Department of Government Efficiency to hand over documents related to DOGE's operations. The case was brought by 14 Democratic attorneys general and argues DOGE has been unconstitutionally ordering the mass federal layoffs. In a surprise turnabout, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer announced he's voting for a Republican measure to keep the government funded, splitting from the majority of the Democratic caucus, which had been poised to block the bill. Schumer argued that letting the government shut down would cause even more harm to people and give free rein to President Trump and Elon Musk to further dismantle federal agencies. Most Democrats say the continuing resolution would also be a blank check for the White House and will defund essential food, education and health care programs. It's not clear yet which other Democrats will support Schumer's move other than Senator John Fetterman, who had already announced he would vote in favor of the funding package. At least eight Democrats need to back the measure alongside Republicans for it to pass. The news left many House Democrats incensed, including New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's been calling on her supporters to ramp up public pressure on Democrats to vote down the bill. She addressed reporters from a Democratic policy retreat in Leesburg, Virginia.
Just to see Senate Democrats even consider acquiescing to Elon Musk, I think it is a huge slap in the face, and I think that there's a wide sense of betrayal.
Meanwhile, young students, parents, and teachers from D.C. schools rallied at Senate offices Thursday to speak out against the spending measure, which they warn will trigger a devastating $1 billion cut to education and their services in the Capitol. Here in New York, police arrested some 100 protesters as the group Jewish Voice for Peace led a major sit-in protest inside Trump Tower to call for the release of detained Palestinian activist, recent Columbia University graduate Mahmoud Khalil. Those arrested include Jewish elders, descendants of Holocaust survivors, and students. Demonstrators donned red T-shirts with the message, "Jews say stop arming Israel," as they took over the lobby of the Manhattan skyscraper. This is Nate Cohen, a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, speaking outside Trump Tower.
We know that fascist regimes try these things. They test these cases. They try to see if people will comply, if people will roll over and allow them to force this kind of illegal, undemocratic activity on us. And we believe that it's deeply important to stand up in these kinds of moments to say that we will not sit idly by, we will not comply. Never again means right now, never again means for everyone. What happened to Mahmoud should never have happened, and we're not going to let it happen to anyone else.
Also Thursday, the Council on American-Islamic Relations filed a new lawsuit on behalf of Mahmoud Khalil and other Columbia students against Columbia University and a U.S. House committee for respectively disclosing and requesting student records. A lawyer for CARE said, quote, "No student should fear that their private information will be handed over to politicians who seek to punish advocacy for Palestinian human rights," unquote. This all came as Columbia announced it had expelled, suspended, and revoked the diplomas of a number of students who took part in a campus anti-war protest last spring. The protest saw students take over a school building and rename it Hinz Hall in honor of Hind Rajab, a six-year-old girl killed by Israeli soldiers in Gaza, along with her family. Also on Thursday, the Trump administration issued a letter to Colombia demanding a list of immediate next steps in order to open discussions on restoring $400 million in government funding that was rescinded less than a week ago. The steps include banning face masks, ramping up its law enforcement authority and placing the Middle East, South Asian and African Studies Department under academic receivership or external oversight. In other related news, Harvard law students overwhelmingly passed a referendum calling on Harvard to divest its more than $50 billion endowment from, quote, weapons, surveillance technology and other companies aiding violations of international humanitarian law, including Israel's genocide in Gaza and its ongoing illegal occupation of Palestine, unquote. Moscow said President Trump and Putin will discuss on the phone a possible 30-day ceasefire in Russia's war on Ukraine, following Russian talks with U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff. On Thursday, Vladimir Putin signaled he's open to a truce proposal as he listed a series of conditions and concerns around ending the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
But who will give orders to cease hostilities? And what will be the price of such orders? Do you imagine almost 2,000 kilometers of front line? Who will figure out who and when in the field of 2,000 kilometers had broken the ceasefire? And then who will blame who in violation of this agreement?
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Putin of manipulation, explaining, quote, Putin often does this. He does not say no directly, but he does it in such a way that only delays and makes normal decisions impossible, unquote. NBC News is reporting President Trump has directed the Pentagon to develop proposals to advance his threats to seize the Panama Canal. The U.S. Southern Command's reportedly drafting potential plans to increase U.S. military presence in Panama and partner more closely with Panamanian forces in an attempt to diminish China's influence and cut off its access to ports in the Panama Canal. NBC News report is based on the accounts of two U.S. officials. Panamanian officials responded saying, quote, our sovereignty over the Panama Canal is absolute and not the basis of any negotiation, unquote. The Panama Canal Authority is run entirely by the Panamanian government, not China, as Trump has falsely claimed. Meanwhile, Trump was asked about his threats to annex Greenland during an Oval Office meeting with the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte. Trump's reply, quote, I think it will happen, unquote. During their meeting, Rutte praised Trump and vowed to keep rallying NATO members to increase military spending. Syria's transitional president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, signed a temporary constitution Thursday, declared the start of a new history for Syria. Ahmed al-Sharaa, who led the rebel offensive that toppled Bashar al-Assad in December, said the new constitution maintains Islamic law and that the head of the state must be Muslim, as well as enshrining rights of women, the press, and freedom of expression. The document signing came as Israel launched airstrikes on the capital, Damascus. Israel's defense minister threatened to occupy parts of Syria for an unlimited period after deploying its troops following Assad's fall. Meanwhile, the UN warns entire families have been killed in recent sectarian attacks in Syria's coastal region, which is home to the Alawite community. Many have fled across the border to Lebanon, seeking safety.
We stayed at home. We didn't go out. We didn't even stand in front of the windows. We shut the curtains, and we didn't go out at all. All the doors were locked, but we haven't slept for 3 nights. Gunshots. A lot of them. A lot of gunshots. We're not accustomed to that. May God help us.
Argentina's far-right security minister is facing mounting calls to resign over the violent police response to a protest against President Javier Milei's austerity measures and worsening poverty. Over 1,000 riot police were deployed to the streets of Buenos Aires Wednesday in an attempt to crack down on protesters who were tear-gassed and shot with rubber bullets and water cannons. A photographer was left in a coma. Recent protests have been led by retirees who are demanding secure pensions and access to free medications. Cuba's released 553 prisoners despite the collapse of an agreement with the United States that would have seen the easing of sanctions on the island. The deal with the Biden administration was brokered by the Vatican and came to light in January when President Biden announced he'd lift the state sponsor of terrorism designation for Cuba. The measure was quickly reversed by Trump after his inauguration. In related news, the Trump administration's reportedly considering including Cuba and Haiti on a list of countries that could be subjected to a sweeping new travel ban. In other immigration news, the Trump administration's resumed placing asylum-seeking families in detention, restarting a practice that caused the death of at least six migrant children during Trump's first term. The nonprofit group Raices is reporting at least 14 immigrant families, some with children as young as a year old, are currently jailed at a facility in Karnes County, Texas, after being apprehended near the Mexican-Canadian borders. The families are from Colombia, Romania, Iran, Angola, Russia, Armenia, Turkey, and Brazil. Family detention have been largely suspended, though not abolished, under the Biden administration. The facility where the families are being held is run by the private company Geo Group, which has been repeatedly accused of abuse, including medical neglect. This comes as the Justice Department has dropped a Biden-era sexual abuse lawsuit against Southwest Key, the largest provider of housing for unaccompanied immigrant children. The move comes after the Health and Human Services Department said it had stopped contracting Southwest Key services. Survivors of abuse said workers forced children to perform sexual acts and pose for nude photos while threatening them with retaliation. And longtime Democratic Congress member Raul Grijalva died Thursday from complications from cancer treatment. For decades, Grijalva represented Arizona's 7th Congressional District, a vast border region that included his hometown of Tucson. He was a leading progressive voice who championed immigrant rights and environmental justice. Grijalva was the longest-serving co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and a member of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Grijalva's father immigrated from Mexico through the Bracero program, which allowed agricultural workers to temporarily come to the U.S. between the early 40s and 60s. Democracy Now! Spoke to Congressmember Grijalva in 2017, just days before Trump was inaugurated for his first term.
When the public comes into the discussion, when they are part of it, when they put that kind of pressure on. And that's part of the strategy that I think going forward is so important. Those of us that are in Congress that are opposed to what's going on are a voice. But the real power in holding back some of the worst instincts of Trump and the majority in the House and in the Senate is going to come from people themselves.
Arizona will have to hold special elections to pick Raul Grijalva's successor. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And those were headlines from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, March 14th. You're listening to KORC.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. This is Dan Kral, and I am at the Art Center in Corvallis. I'm joined by Jenny. And I understand that there is some spring break activity coming up for the kiddos here at the Art Center.
Yeah, we're offering our spring arts adventures over spring break at the end of March. And this year we're offering two classes. We're offering Adventures in Comics with Jen Hernandez. And that class will be held at the Corvallis Museum. And we're also holding a Intro to Darkroom Photography class that will be held at Light Writer Studios with Koa Tom.
Tell me about Adventures in Comics. I guess it's geared toward grades 4 through 8.
Right. The class for the younger kids this year. And Jen helps them create their own comic characters and comic strips in zine and digital comic form.
Cool. What else is going on with the Intro to Darkroom?
So Intro to Darkroom Photography is for older kids. We're offering that for grades 8 through 12. And it'll be at Light Writer Studios, which has a full darkroom. Students will be given a camera that they can borrow, and they'll shoot a roll of 35mm film. They'll learn how to develop that, and then Co will help them scan it so that they can potentially make prints and have those analog pictures on their phone at the end of the day. So, yeah.
Or something they can actually hang on the wall.
Yeah.
Or frame.
Yeah, the physicality of darkroom photography is so fun. So I'm a photographer myself, and that's where I started, in the darkroom. And I don't think kids these days have had that same experience because they're walking around with a camera on their phone all the time. So this is a really unique experience to see how analog photography works and see the magic in the darkroom.
Absolutely. And what are the dates on these programs?
The classes will be offered over spring break, which is March 24th through 28th, 2025.
A good way to keep the kids busy. Keep them out of trouble.
Yeah, and keep them creative. That's the main goal there.
And there's more information, I assume, at your website?
Yes, you can sign up for the classes on our website and read more information there about each of the courses. Our website is theartcenter.net, and the program is called Spring Arts Adventures.
All right. Well, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics.
The following story on the Pacific Lamprey is from a video project by Freshwaters Illustrated, a nonprofit right here in Corvallis that is working to raise public awareness about the life, study, and conservation of freshwater ecosystems through immersive visual media and storytelling. This video is produced in partnership with the Friends of Tryon Creek and in cooperation with the Pacific Lamprey Conservation Initiative and the Tryon Creek State Natural Area. You can find more stories and info, including how to donate, at freshwatersillustrated.org. Every spring, Pacific lamprey migrate from the ocean into coastal rivers like the Columbia, following ancient migratory pathways, which intersect with ancestral places of the eel harvest. You're hearing the sounds of Willamette Falls and the voice of Gabe Showships, a member of the Cayuse tribe.
For me, being able to go to the falls is a real privilege. You just take in kind of the vastness of the area, the water, the sounds, the crashing, you know, the rocks themselves, all that history. But all of that really makes the experience of going to the falls a very unique, very special, and it comes with an inherent responsibility of continuing that cultural practice, you know, despite a lot of change in 170 years or so at that place. Willamette Falls is an important intertribal harvest and gathering area, and always has been. There's, you know, 40, 50,000 year history of tribal people using that space. It's one of the few places where you can actively harvest lamprey today. The species themselves are so much in decline, and there's not many large rivers around that still support lamprey and then support a harvest area like Willamette Falls. And for the few fish that are called back to the Willamette, this is literally kind of the last leg of their trip. They've come a long way, and they're solely focused on returning to spawn. And once they traverse the falls, that's not the last barrier that they really have to overcome.
You're now hearing the sound of Tryon Creek, an ancestral lamprey spawning and rearing tributary of the Willamette River south of Portland.
Lamprey as a species have been around for 450 to 500 million years. And to have seen such a decline within a very short time, you know, it's a strong indicator of kind of where we're at and of how we're able to steward or support forests, rivers, streams, riparian habitat, everything that lamprey utilize. You know, typically in the small, medium-sized streams of the Pacific Northwest, they're homes to lamprey. So they're all around us. Many folks don't notice them just because they live in the sediments. Growing up, I always heard that larval lamprey or young lamprey would clean river systems. They literally kind of feed on organic or detritus material. And they like this kind of movable, sandy sediment that they can burrow into. Tryon Creek, as an urban stream, is pretty protected. You know, about two-thirds of the stream is within Tryon Creek State Natural Area. You know, you can have healthy habitat and a relatively healthy forest and pretty decent water quality, but if these fish aren't able to access this place, then they're not going to be here. If I had to guess, I would say it's been 50 or 60 years plus that a lamprey has been in this creek. it's a teaching moment, and that's kind of what drives my work. This is a common basketry item, gathering item for the original peoples of Western Oregon. These are native shrubs. I've worked in fishery science, and I bring some of those tools into my role at the Friends of Tryon Creek, which is more education, community stewardship, restoration, and community reconnection.
Does anybody know what this is? Any guesses? What it's carved as? Good, a fish. It's the oldest living fish. It has a lot of different names. An eel is what tribes call it. In Western science, it's called a lamprey.
This forest is kind of our living laboratory, our meeting place. So we're in a unique space, and this is a motivator to build those relationships with communities that don't have access. And ultimately, that will benefit and better this place. If more people care about it, more people are stewarding it, and more people have that knowledge to take wherever they go in life.
So and eels have an important presence today. There's not a whole lot left. So folks like myself and Greg are looking to you all to kind of step up and protect and save them.
It's definitely a good way to talk about the work, is that you need all of the complexities in place to make things happen. Lamprey are a great teacher of that. Modern Western society has created a lot of barriers, both physical and also socio-emotional, whether it's in a river or it's a societal structure that limits folks from continuing their cultural knowledge or even accessing a forest like this. So we're working to promote holistic access for people into this park. We're also working to restore native communities of fish and provide them holistic access to this place, which is also their home. We're laying that groundwork where lamprey will return to this creek and bring it intact again.
Every year, over 20,000 young learners from all communities connect to forests, water, and cultural ecology through the Friends of Tryon Creek. Pacific lamprey are still blocked from Tryon Creek by an impassable highway culvert. Help the Friends of Tryon Creek bring indigenous cultural values, inclusive community, and native biodiversity back to Tryon Creek. Visit www.tryonfriends.org for more information. This was a story on the Pacific Lamprey from a video project by Freshwaters Illustrated, a nonprofit in Corvallis that's working to raise public awareness about the life, study, and conservation of freshwater ecosystems through immersive visual media and storytelling. This video is produced in partnership with the Friends of Tryon Creek and in cooperation with the Pacific Lamprey Conservation Initiative and the Tryon Creek State Natural Area. You can find more stories and info, including how to donate, at freshwatersillustrated.org.
How serious is youth vaping? Irreversible lung damage serious? 1 in 10 kids vape serious? Which warrants a serious conversation from a serious parental figure, like yourself. Not the seriously know-it-all sports dad, or the seriously smart podcaster. It requires a serious conversation that is best had by you. No, seriously, the best person to talk to your child about vaping is you. To start the conversation, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.